Regina Carter is considered the foremost jazz violinist of her generation. She studied at the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston and Oakland University. She lived and played in Germany and Detroit before moving to New York City to play with the New York String Trio for 6 years. She then launched her career as a bandleader, releasing several albums of contemporary jazz and drew attention for her work on the recording of Wynton Marsalis' composition, Blood on the Fields, which won a Pulitzer Prize. She toured with Marsalis in 1997 and went on the road with jazz vocalist Cassandra Wilson in 1998. In 2006, she was selected as a recipient of the MacArthur Genius Award. Her current project is Simply Ella, celebrating the centennial of Ella Fitzgerald's birth, which she will perform at the Egg at 8 p.m. tonight. It is a great pleasure, and I hope you will join me in welcoming Regina Carter.
Thank you.
That's a beautiful violin.
Thank you.
What is it?
It's not a pedigree.
Okay. am I allowed to ask? Like, what kind of violin is that?
No, it's a copy of it's an Italian violin that was made in the 1700s, but it's not a pedigree, and a lot of the parts have been changed or damaged. So, but when I went into the shop and tried out instruments, I loved the sound of this. It's more of an alto voice, a warm voice, and so that's why I chose this one.
Do you have more than one, or is this the one, the main one that you play?
This is the main one. I have two. The other one I use if I play in rock bands or really loud bands. I have a pickup on that, and I use it when this one is in the shop. But this is my main instrument.
How many rock bands do you play with?
Well, I did a tour with Joe Jackson, actually.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
For a couple of months back in, I think it was 2012. Just once in a while, or if it's a Latin band, sometimes I've done gigs with Eddie Palmieri.
When you go on and you were looking for a sound, I assume you have some idea of what you're looking for.
Yes, I know. I like a very dark and warm sounding, almost like a viola, if you will, mm-hmm. that kind of sound. Some violins have a more soprano or a high pitch. The E string really rings out, and I don't like that sound in my ear. And for jazz, I feel like a darker sound. And I love the sound that the violinist Duff Smith would get. And I learned that he used to put a mute on the bridge to help darken the sound. Mm-hmm. Or some people fill the F holes with foam to help kind of deaden the sound. I didn't want it to be dead, but I just wanted a darker.
You think of how we use a violin, and you're classically trained, and so you think of that then, the instrument then being used in a jazz setting. We also think of it used in a country setting. Then the violin then becomes the fiddle. But in jazz, it's still the violin and still a classical instrument, isn't it?
Well, I mean, it's just a piece of wood with strings on it. So it, when you think about it, in every culture of music, there's some stringed instrument that the violin is related to. So it's really a young instrument when
yes.
you think about it. So it's and every culture has its classical music. So it's been a part of jazz from the beginning. It's just I think there were so few violinists. That people didn't realize the violin isn't celebrated or accepted as much as, say, trumpet, saxophone, guitar. So, you know, people say, oh, there's no such thing as jazz violin, or I've never heard of jazz violin, but they've been out here. It's just, you know, like I said, the industry wasn't so welcoming.
You have played and play several instruments, and the one thing I noted is it's pretty eclectic, isn't it?
Yes.
Talk a little bit about some of the instruments you play besides the violin.
Well, I don't play anymore.
This when you were starting out.
Yes, I started on piano.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that was how my mother was a kindergarten teacher, and her mother graduated from Morris Brown University in 1915 with a degree in pedagogy, and so it was important, you know, and that was very uncommon for a woman and an African-American woman at that time. So education and music were really important in our household. So my mom put my older brothers in music. They were taking piano lessons. And one day they said, when I was 2 years old, I walked up to the piano and started playing one of the pieces they were working on. And everyone was shocked, and the teacher said, "Who taught her that?" And they said, "No one. We didn't even know she could play." So they signed me up for piano lessons, and I would go in, and instead of playing the pieces from my book, they said I would go in and tell my teacher, "Here's my piece I wrote." And back then, remember in first grade when you're learning how to write, you had the green paper with the three lines.
Sure.
And so my mom would have all these supplies. So I would use that and draw these big circles like dinosaur eggs, and that would be my tune. And this teacher actually kept those. And when I graduated from high school, she made a book out of them and gave them to my mom as a gift. But she didn't want to force me to learn how to read because she thought she would turn me off to the love of music. So she told my mother to let me stay home and just continue to compose and be creative. And then when I was four, the Suzuki method was being offered for the first time in Detroit, Michigan, where I'm from. And that method, you learn to play by ear. It's the same way we learn to speak a language when we're growing up. And I just took to it. I loved it. I had private lessons once a week, and then on Saturdays we'd have group lessons or orchestra, and it was fun. It was a lot of fun. I just really fell in love with it.
In your training, what do you see the difference between a traditionally trained violinist and someone who is trained through the Suzuki method?
And there's so many methods out now. Yeah. Maybe for some of the other methods, children are taught to read first or at the start. I know with Suzuki, some of the complaints are that children don't learn how to read soon enough, which I agree. My teacher, because my ear was so strong, didn't start me reading and probably until I was about 10 or 11, which is too late. So my sight reading chops are horrendous, but I can hear. And right. For me, for what I do, I think that's important. First of all, it's important for every musician to be able to hear and to listen. But I'm not afraid to be off paper, or if I'm reading a piece of music and I fumble and don't make the note, I know how to make up something and keep going so the audience doesn't know. And I'm not afraid to improvise or to make up things.
Which, of course, is a hallmark of jazz,
right,
too.
Right, right. And actually Baroque music as well.
Right.
So probably Suzuki students could learn to read sooner, but I think all children learning music should definitely have ear training. So, I don't know. I think everyone has to find what works for them. There's not one that's any better than the other. It's just really what works for each individual.
I started taking violin lessons when I was 5 years old from a man who played was a violinist for the Philadelphia Orchestra, and his name was Franz Zettelmeier. He was German. And he was also very strict. I know, I was shocked too. But I was really surprised because that was one thing that I would wander off sometime and he would say, "I want you to hear the music, I don't want you to hear something else."
Hmm.
And I felt, I guess kind of constricted by that. Which is why the other methods have always fascinated me.
Right. Well, at least he wanted you to hear the music.
Yes.
Because some people don't even concentrate on hearing or listening, and it's just more about what's on the page, and people forget how to listen, even to each other. But that was, I think, when I was in college, when I was at New England, I auditioned for both the classical and the jazz department, so I was kind of doing both, and my teacher, I was doing Bach one day, and he kept stopping me, saying, "No, it's not like this, it's like this. No, it's not." And I remember I was just at wit's end, and it came flying out of my mouth before I realized. I was like, "How do you know? Did you talk to Bach?" You know, just a very smart-alecky answer. And so I knew then, you know what, you don't need to do this.
And then, I assume, then comes a comfort with the instrument, right? You become one with the instrument and a comfort with the instrument that allows you to not only play pieces that are prescribed, but also things that you want to create.
Right, yes. And that comfort sometimes I have that comfort and sometimes I don't. You know, it just depends. I'm working on a piece now that's, a lot of it is jumping from first position way up here in double stops, and double stops have never been my friend, so.
I don't know that they're anybody's friend, are they?
Some people can just, you know, they've worked on them and have them. I don't. I know my limitations, so I try to, if I'm doing a piece, then I know, okay, take this out and put this in. I can kind of rework the piece so it works for me, but some things, if I don't have it by now, I'm not going to have it. I can't worry about it. I'll let someone else do it. So.
Do you have a show-off piece, something that you say, oh, this can show what I can do?
Yeah, I think kind of two pieces, but I think probably Don't Explain, which is, I love playing ballads. I feel like that's my strong suit because you can be very expressive with it. And then I put a cadenza on the end that's very classical-ish. It's like I patterned it after Gideon Kremer's from Erwelpert Fratres, I think it was.
Beautiful. And what was the other one?
Sometimes, not always, but sometimes Lady Be Good.
Oh, wow. Yeah. There you go.
Because it's more of a swing, you know.
Yeah. Mr. Zettelmeyer always played the Hot Canary. Florian Zabek, do you remember that? Anybody remember that? Yeah, that's what I said. when you started this Ella Fitzgerald project, how did that, I assume there's a comfort with that because it's music, obviously, that has been very important to you.
Yes, we had Ella records in our house, all kinds of music in our house growing up. But I always remember as a child when I would put Ella on, I would immediately feel good, feel warm, feel loved. I would daydream about what my life would be like as an adult hearing this music. I thought that I would go out dancing to this music. So it was really warm. And then as an adult, I realized what an extraordinary gift she had with being able to scat and sound just like the instruments in the band. So I would always, in the morning, get up and put Ella on in the morning to just kind of help start my day, set the tone for the day. And I've recorded, on a couple of different records, I've recorded tunes that she's done. Mm-hmm. But with this being her 100th birthday, I thought it would be a great idea just to do a whole record of Ella tunes. And I decided, because I felt like many people would do tribute records to her, I decided to do her B-side tunes. So a lot of the tunes people haven't heard of, or maybe a couple they've heard, I played little samples on the phone so they hear her version of it, and then we do our arrangements, but so they hear what the tunes actually sounded like. And I'm introducing people to some people to tunes that they've not heard that she's recorded.
Is the idea where you come in the arrangement, it's where her vocal would be, correct?
Yes.
So what, I would assume something like that could get in your head to say, oh, I'm about to play the Ella part now.
Well, no, it's just playing the melody, because so many people have recorded these tunes, but I hear, because I listen to her, I hear maybe how she would phrase the tune, but I'm not trying to sound like Ella. It's just a nod to her, respect to her, because it's our job is to take the music forward or to have our own voice in it, but I respect the melody, so I know the words to the melodies, and I kind of hear her singing sometimes in my head when I'm playing the tune, and so I'm hoping that the words come through the violin when I'm playing them.
Do you find it disconcerting when you see people's mouth move in the audience?
No, because mine is probably moving. They might find it because mine is.
So it's okay.
They don't want to hear anything come out of my mouth, but it'll be moving. So.
And when you put a group of musicians together, your current group, have you all been together for a while?
We've been, the guitarist, Marvin Sewell, is probably the newest person. We worked together for Southern Comfort, that's when we started working together. But I worked with him in Cassandra Wilson's band, and I've heard him in other bands, and said back then that I wanted to work with him one day. So Southern Comfort was the perfect opportunity. The drummer, we've worked together on and off since the early 90s. The bass player, since the early 2000s, we've worked together. And Xavier Davis on piano, we've worked together on and off since 2004.
Talk a little bit about that album, about Southern Comfort. That was an album that really was very personal to you, and but also gave you, I would think, gave you a chance to explore.
Yes.
The music.
Yes. I was very curious about my grandfather, and so I knew he was a coal miner in Alabama, and he passed away before I was born. He was born in 1893, I think it was. And it was difficult to find out information from him. The family was pretty closed-mouthed about him. So I would get bits and pieces here and there, and I joined Ancestry.com and started hooking my tree up to other people's and finding out bits and pieces. So I felt like if I discovered the music that would have been relevant during his lifetime, that would give me another look into his life. And so I started researching music at the Library of Congress and the Alabama Folklife Association. And it was some pretty amazing recordings. Some things were really ugly, you know, just very racist recordings, but that's part of our history. And I remember doing a concert once with the Carolina Chocolate Drops, and we were talking about that, and they said, well, yeah, it is an ugly part, but instead of burying it or ignoring it and pretending it doesn't exist, it's art still, it's part of our history. Let's look at it, because it forced us to create and to protest, but using our art to do that. So it served a purpose. So I found some really interesting music out there. So some of the music would have been during the time that he was born through his whole life up to present. And some of the tunes, it was interesting because they were field recordings, so it was just one person singing on a lot of these recordings, and I play them, and then we play our arrangements on these pieces. And I have people from all over the world. I remember we were in Birdland playing one night in New York, and there was a tour group of Finnish people there. And they said, we know that song, you know, different words, but our grandmother used to sing that song to us. And what's beautiful about this music out of the Appalachia area is that it's a mixture of music from the Europeans, you know, the Scots, Irish, Native Americans, African Americans, all these people. So everyone's kind of bringing in music and songs and stories from their parts of the world, and they got meshed together and formed this very beautiful Americana sound.
Because it is a tune, it is music, obviously, did everything that you wanted to adapt to the violin adapt to the violin?
No. No. And just because I love a tune doesn't mean, you know, I try it on my instrument. Sometimes it just doesn't work. I don't know if it's because it's me playing it on the instrument or it's the instrument. It just doesn't work, and I'll try it. So the process of putting a record together for me is a long one. I'll find tunes, and then I say, what do I want to do with this project? And sometimes I have an idea, this is what I'm going to do for this project. And I end up listening, and, you know, I look at the liner notes and say, who was playing on this? And I hear something really interesting. And it's like, what is this? And I check that out, and it leads me in a whole nother direction. So I always say the music leads me where I need to be at that particular time. And then I get the band together and we try these arrangements. Sometimes we play them live and we'll say, okay, this worked, this didn't work. We can either change the arrangement or we just throw the tune out and, you know, keep adding to it until, and then I look at what I have and see what makes sense as far as a story, if you will. Do all these tunes and the arrangements, do they belong together?
Mm. Is there a point where, as you say, not all of it adapts? So how patient are you in that process, in the sense of, I'm going to work on this, and if it, the point where you know yes or no that it's going to work?
I'm not patient about anything. So it doesn't work. I might try, someone, you know, the guys might say, well, let's try slowing it down, or let's try this, or let's try a different key. And then right away, if it doesn't, I'm like, forget it, let's move on. I just don't have patience for anything. I don't.
When you can start putting the word genius on your resume, how does that change things?
Yeah, I don't put that on there. Me and Wile E. Coyote.
Super genius.
I remember when my husband found out, he said, they gave you a genius award. You can't even get around the block without getting lost. And so, and it's true. It's just, so, yeah.
But it's first of all, it's nice cash, but
yes.
But also it gives you time to work on something.
Yes. So,
and for you, that was mostly the Southern Cumber project?
Yes. Well, no, actually it was Reverse Thread. That was the first project of mostly African music that I researched and, you know, put a couple of bands, changed the band around. And that project I probably researched for a year and then started playing. And that whole process took about 2 years. And then also shopping it took another year. And when I shopped it to labels, I was leasing it. And whoever would pick it up, they had to take it as is. They couldn't make any changes to it. So
that
took a while.
Yeah.
But I had the comfort of knowing, you know, I can wait.
Right. Because it's 5 years, right? They give you 5 years pretty much with the
MacArthur?
Yes. Yeah. So when you have that luxury, then does that... do you want that all the time?
Yes.
Which I guess you could sort of have, right?
No.
No,
it came, you know, it's funny to say it came at the perfect time, but that kind of cash, whenever it comes, is the perfect time. But,
yeah.
You know, I had lost my mom the year before, and I was sued by a festival for canceling when she was dying, and the lawsuit lasted exactly a year. And then I got the call about the MacArthur Award probably a month after that lawsuit ended. So I felt like, and I was really angry and pretty bitter, but I felt like it was kind of her way of saying, it's okay, green light, you know, you can go forward. But it also gave me an opportunity just to step back from music for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And also when I spent that time with her in the hospital, there was a point where she couldn't communicate, and I would take recordings and play them in her room, and I saw that some recordings I put on her vital signs would get really wacky, and then sometimes I'd take that off and put something else on, and they kind of simmer back down. So then you always hear music is powerful, but when you see it like that, you understand exactly how powerful it is. And so I became really interested in music and medicine. So then I took a class at Western University in Kalamazoo, Michigan. They set up an online program for me to do that. And I thought I'd be a music therapist, but that wasn't quite what I wanted to do. So I ended up doing hospice volunteer work instead. And I find that really fulfilling.
Well, that's great. Well, you have to be patient to do that.
Yeah, but it's patient with others. I can be patient with someone else. I can't be patient with myself.
Well, that's why you hold yourself to a high standard, sure. That makes sense. I don't want to bring up an old wound, but did you win the lawsuit?
No.
Really?
I mean, we settled, and it was a lot of money out of pocket, but we settled.
Because that seems like a real jerk move on their part.
Yeah, certain cultures don't, certain cultures think honor your words, certain cultures think honor your parents. And we're an honor your parents culture, and that culture was an honor your word.
Wow. Do you... When you take on a project like this, so what, if folks are going to the show tonight, how many are going to the show tonight, by the way? Oh, look at them.
Yay.
All. Hey, that's great. So when everyone in the audience goes to the show tonight, what is the, we could have just had it down there. We get a card pulled. This is the result of how many years of work now?
This Ella project? Ooh. Probably two and a half years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the album isn't even out yet. That'll come out later.
No, that'll come out in April. Yes.
And you'll be ready for that.
Well, I better be. I better be ready tonight at 8. So.
But once you do it, and you have the recording, you go out on tour, are you immediately thinking of the next thing, or do you let that stay with you for a while?
It has to stay with me. It has to simmer for a while, because I usually tour on a record 2 to 3 years. Most people put out records more than I do, at a shorter time span in between than I do. I tend not to. It takes me a long time to figure out what it is I want to do, because my interests are all over the place. And I don't want to just say, oh, I'm just going to do these tunes and put this on a record. It has to, what's important for me at that time, what is it that I want to say? What's the theme of the project? So I have to take time and figure that out. And my mind changes every week. And so then I just start. The hardest part is just starting. And then I just sit down and say, okay, even if I say it's going to be, women composers before the 40s. I start with that, and I start collecting music, and then maybe a recording takes me somewhere else, and I end up now it's, women from, Uganda, that or this, and then it turns into prayer music. Oh, prayer music from around the world. And so then by the very end, it can be something completely different.
Is it okay? Would you play something for us?
Sure.
That was Regina Carter playing violin at the end of our interview at UAlbany on February 11th. The conversation was part of the New York State Writers Institute, the Creative Life Series.
That night, she played a concert entitled Simply Ella at the Egg. Her album, Ella, Accentuate the Positive, will be released in April. The next guest in the New York State Writers Institute, the Creative Life Series, is renowned painter David Sally. He'll be in Albany on March 23rd. Links to more information are posted along with this interview at wamc.org/roundtable. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.